Have you always believed that dividend-paying stocks were the best way to create reliable income in your retirement? If so, you don't want to miss this episode of the Atlas Annuity Podcast, where we take a trip down memory lane of some of the biggest fails of dividend-paying stock history. Hi, everyone. This is Marty Becker, owner and founder of Atlas Financial Strategies in St. Louis, Missouri. Welcome to episode number 62 of the Atlas Annuity Podcast. In this episode, we're going to compare dividend-paying stocks to guaranteed income annuities. Now, let me be perfectly clear that I am not anti-stock by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, if you're going to own stocks, in my personal opinion, they should be dividend-paying stocks so you can get the benefit of the compounding effect, which Einstein called the eighth wonder of the world. And that way, you're not relying just on share price increasing to expand your net worth. And I understand that there are certain dividend stocks that can be tax advantaged. However, when we're talking about ROI in your retirement, it no longer should stand for return on investment. ROI, once you retire, needs to stand for reliability of income. And when it comes to reliability of income, there is nothing more reliable than a guaranteed income annuity. So let's just take a look at a handful of dividend-paying stocks that were considered rock solid to provide you with dividend income. Now, I got this information directly from dividend.com and was researched by Shauna O'Brien. So I don't want to take credit where someone else already did the work. So if you're watching this on YouTube, I apologize because I'm going to be reading this pretty much right off my screen. First company we're going to look at is Kodak. Eastman Kodak is a photographic and imaging equipment company that was founded in 1888. The company was very well positioned in the industry during the 1970s, but began to struggle in the 1990s when the print photo industry began to crumble. Kodak paid a quarterly dividend for several decades, hitting its prime in 1988 with a quarterly payout of 50 cents per share. The dividend amount later declined to 40 cents in 1994, but then went up by 4 cents to a total of 44 in 1997. For the next 6 years until 2003, the company paid a consistent 44 cent dividend every quarter, with an average of a 6.7% dividend yield. That sounds pretty good. Now, in October of 2003, the company cut its dividend by 43% to 25 cents quarterly, decreasing the dividend yield to 1.9%. That doesn't sound so good. Kodak reported that the drastic cut in dividends was due to a new company strategy that included increased investment in newer technology. Digital photographs? Okay. The news brought Kodak's stock down 18% in a single day. Finally, in April 2009, Kodak announced that it would no longer pay dividends on its stock as a result of declining sales. In January of 2012, the company, which had been struggling for years, declared bankruptcy. Yikes. Radio Shack. Everybody remembers Radio Shack. It was founded in 1921. And is an electronics retailer with locations in the United States, Europe, South America, and Africa. I didn't know they were that big. Radio Shack paid its first quarterly dividend of 3 cents in 1987. The company held a steady quarterly dividend with occasional increases until 2001. Weak sales in cell phones and computers hurt electronic retailers into 2000 to 2001, sending shares of Radio Shack plummeting. In 2002, Radio Shack initiated an annual dividend while the share price continued to collapse. And Radio Shack yields skyrocketed by 2012. And in the second half of 2012, Radio Shack suspended its dividend completely. So here's something to take into account. So it said that the dividend yield skyrocketed. The reason that when you're looking at these dividend paying stocks, when you see a dividend yield of like 10% or something, that means the stock is losing value and they just haven't changed the dividend amount. So it looks extremely attractive, a little bit more underneath the surface that you have to take into consideration. JCPenney's. I remember JCPenney's. They had the Husky section when I was a kid. My mom told me I was just big bone. That's why we had a shop there. JCPenney was founded in 19 and became famous for its catalogs and department stores. JCPenney initiated its first quarterly dividend in 1987. The company increased its dividend until 2000, when it cut its dividend for the first time from 54.5 cents to 28 cents. So basically, if you were getting dividends from them, you took a 50% pay cut, like overnight. In October of 2000, JCPenney slashed its dividend again, another 50-plus percent pay cut. This payout amount remained unchanged until the company saw an upside in 2005. In 2006, JCPenney increased its dividend from 12.5 cents to 18 cents. Although JCPenney's share price began to sink in 2007, the company boosted its dividend again to 20 cents per share. During this time, its share price tumbled and JCPenney's share price continued to fall 80% over the next 2 years. JCPenney suspended its 20 cent dividend completely in 2012. No more income. Sorry. General Motors. Now, there's an old saying, as General Motors goes, so goes the country. GM is an American multinational corporation founded in 1908 and the largest automaker in the United States. GM paid a reliable, consistent dividend for several decades during its glory days. In the mid-2000s, however, most of you probably remember this, the company hit a major snag. With the dividend yield rising over 10%, the stock was seemingly still an attractive investment. Again, don't buy into the yield. See what's going on underneath the surface. After all, it had reliably paid a 50 cent dividend each quarter from 1997 to 2005. The reason for such a high yield? Here we go. A sharply dropping share price. GM shares plunged from over $60 in early 2003 to under $20 in early 2006. So about a 66% loss. Unfortunately, all too many investors didn't realize that eye-popping yield was simply too good to be true. In February of 2006, GM cut its dividend in half to 25 cents per share. Sorry guys, you just lost 66% of your value and you're taking a 50% pay cut. On May 15, 2008, the company paid its last 25 cent dividend. GM promptly suspended its dividend altogether. Sorry, no more income. Sold $4 to $7 billion in assets and cut 20% of its salary costs to save billions of dollars. And still, some investors held on. Then came the final blow. In 2009, GM declared bankruptcy. The stock price went to zero. Thankfully for its employees, the company was subsequently bailed out by the U.S. government. GM later became public once again in October 2011 on the New York Stock Exchange. And on January 15, 2014, the company announced it would reinstate its dividend. I'm sure that was a wild ride for anybody depending on that income. Ford. Here's another one. Ford Motor Company is arguably one of the most popular names in automobiles across the globe, dating all the way back to Henry Ford and the revolutionary Model T. Fast forward to 2006, when the company was having trouble maintaining profitability and its dividends alike. In September of that year, the firm announced a major move in which it would cut 10,000 salary jobs and shutter two plants with the goal of returning to profitability in 2009. This plan also included halting the company's dividend, which had been decreasing in recent years as Ford had struggled to stay relevant. In 2006, Ford made its last dividend payment for the next 6 years. In December of 2011, the company announced it would reinstate the dividend. So March 1st, 2012, Ford pays a dividend and the company made a quarterly distribution of 5 cents. The dividend reinstatement came as the company had effectively lowered its debts and had consistently generated positive earnings and cash flow. 6 years before these people ever got a dividend back. Can you survive 6 years if a chunk of your income is taken away? A lot of people can. Some can. Citigroup. Now, this is a banking institution. These guys literally print money, okay? This New York-based firm is among the largest financial services companies in the world, operating in over 140 countries. I didn't know that. Starting with 9 cents a share in 1998, the company paid increasing dividends each quarter for several years. By May 2003, the company's dividend had increased to 23 cents. That's a pretty good jump, over 100%, and then increased again 3 months later to 35 cents. In 2007, dividend payments for Citigroup were at an all-time high of 54 cents. At this time, the subprime mortgage crisis was becoming more and more of a problem, resulting in the company cutting its dividends by 40% in the beginning of 2008 to 32 cents. In October of 2008, the dividends were sliced again by 50% to 16 cents, and then to just 1 cent in January 2009. Sorry, I'm not laughing if this affected you personally. It's unbelievable to think about. The company chose not to pay a dividend for the next 2.5 years, with its stock sticking under $5 per share in May 2011. Citi pulled some real financial chicanery, executing an almost unheard of 1-for-10 reverse stock split. That move pumped its share price up to $45, and it resumed a 1 penny per share dividend payout, which continues to this day. That's not good. Boeing. Now, this one's an interesting one to me because there is a manufacturing plant in St. Louis to this day, and I know some people that still work at Boeing and some others who have already retired from Boeing. Now, besides the obvious problem of freaking airplane doors falling off in the middle of a flight, or an entire flight just disappearing, like the Malaysia flight back in 2014, there were a bunch of internal problems that were happening at Boeing. So first, in 1997, Boeing acquired McDonnell Douglas. That was the one that was based in St. Louis. While the firm had a great aerospace tradition in building airliners, starting with the iconic DC-3, McDonnell Douglas found it increasingly difficult to compete with first Boeing and then Airbus. However, while the firm's name was retired, the McDonnell Douglas's management team did not leave quietly. The result was that Boeing's idealistic engineering team ended up being run by McDonnell Douglas, hard-bitten veterans. These were accountants, financial controllers, and other managers obsessed with cost savings and used to running things on a shoestring budget. They were also very sensitive to shareholder wealth. The acquisition of McDonnell Douglas, Boeing wanted to minimize its own costs and investments. To do it, simply brought in new risk-sharing partners from Japan, the U.S., Italy, South Korea, and other countries whose aerospace industries were not already closely linked with its rival Airbus. It meant Boeing was able to minimize its own investment and focus on overall system integration and finally assembly by subcontracting the building of plane structures to its partners. For decades, the civilian airline market has been very cyclical. Fluctuations in demand create peaks and troughs in engineering and production needs. Increasingly over time, the new, highly cost-conscious Boeing resorted to layoffs when that demand slackened. Many highly experienced workers and engineers were made redundant, only for Boeing to find that they were no longer available for rehire when demand picked up. Sounds like a problem. While growing reliance on partners and subcontractors made up for the shortfall of skilled personnel, hands-on experience and competence in the actual design and building of the aircraft were lost. This meant that Boeing's high-level system integration capabilities were hard to maintain without a more detailed understanding of how to design and build plane structures. That seems pretty relevant when you're building airplanes. The systems required to control the full design of new airplane configurations are extremely complex. I would think so. Most Boeing engineers at the time only understood a small part of those systems and had to rely on local, quote, experts who had become scarce. Put simply, Boeing underestimated what it took to scale up and run a global supply chain partner network, delivering the hundreds of thousands of parts and sub-assemblies each plane needed. Working with foreign partners and design centers presented unique and unexpected challenges. Our research suggests that one can successfully engage in global innovation projects only by starting small. Boeing went all in. That means just a few partners and a few locations, under the leadership and discipline of experienced global managers. Boeing simply tried to do too much, too fast. In retrospect, Boeing undertook several fundamental changes, seemingly unaware of how ambitious and difficult they were. It moved from having just a few select partners around the world, mostly in Japan, where manufacturing excellence is the norm, I think they call that Kaizen, to building a much larger network of global partners that lacked enough experience of collaboration. This alone was a major transformation. But perhaps the biggest challenge the company faces is trying to overcome the quality control issues that have arisen from the complex and dispersed nature of its supply system. Only time will tell if Boeing can rescue itself from this challenge it has created. Yikes. It went from a highly respected company to biting off more than it can chew, and then having to basically subcontract different parts of these airplanes. No wonder these things are freaking falling out of the sky and the CEOs ended up in front of Congress. So what was the result of all the self-imposed chaos? Well, the last time Boeing paid a dividend was on December 16th, 2019. And on February 14th, 2 months later, 2020, the share price was at $340. By March 20th of 2020, the stock had crashed to $95 per share. That's a 72% loss. No more dividends. And the stock lost 72% within 2 months. As of today, in February 2025, when I'm recording this, the price is still at $181. So it's still sitting approximately half of the value from the last time they paid their shareholders a dividend. So again, what's my point in telling you all these stories? It's not to scare you and to tell you to never have dividend-paying stocks. Of course not. I have dividend-paying stocks, but I'm not relying on them for income, okay? I have them for the compounding effect. My point in telling you this is that if you are relying on dividends for income that you need to survive on in your retirement, there is no guarantee that you will continue to receive them. And an even worse scenario is what happens if your dividend gets suspended and then the stock loses half its value within a month, like it did with Boeing back in 2020. And you have to ask yourself, are you or your advisor going to be able to react fast enough to salvage your money? Because at that point, you're SOL, said and done. Okay, because the money is gone, G-O-N-E, gone. Because at that point, you either have to wait until the stock price hopefully comes back, which in this case, it never did, or you have to lick your wounds and start over somewhere else while you're trying to figure out how to make up for the lost income. What I'm trying to say in this podcast is that if the purpose of your money is to produce income in your retirement, there is nothing as reliable as an income annuity. Not stocks, not bonds, not CDs, not real estate, not precious metals, not crypto. And I get that the principal eventually runs out in income annuities. But even if the annuity runs out of money, it never runs out of income, ever. That's a much better scenario of having your income cut off and then having the value of it cut in half or worse. Define the purpose of your money. And if the purpose is to increase your net worth over the long term, then yes, stocks. If it's to leave a legacy, then it's life insurance. If it's income in retirement, then it's income annuities all day long. And if you're new to annuities, the best way to start educating yourself is by watching my video series, 20% More Spendable Income in Retirement, which you should be able to find the link to in the show notes. And if you would like to find out if my Atlas Annuity strategy will improve your retirement, the best way to get a hold of me is by going to atlasannuity.com and book a short phone call to where you can get your questions answered. And before you go, if you're liking this information and finding it helpful, please subscribe to the podcast and the YouTube channel, like the episode, and share it with someone that you think might find it interesting. Again, this has been episode 62 of the Atlas Annuity Podcast. This is Marty Becker wishing you all the best in your financial education. We'll catch you in the next episode.